Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. 4 months after President James Garfield took office, an insane office seeker named Charles Guiteau shot him twice with a pistol. A team of surgeons and even Alexander Graham Bell could not save him. Candace Millard tells the story of President Garfield's inspiring life and tragic death, and why it was, in fact, a preventable infection and not an assassin's bullet that actually killed him. Her new book is titled Destiny of the Republic. Candace Millard joins me in the studio. You are welcome to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, Candace.
Good morning.
James Garfield is not very well known by anyone, perhaps in fact because he spent so little time in office. Why did you select him?
You know, to be honest, I didn't know much about James Garfield either when I began researching this book, beyond the fact that he had been assassinated. And I wasn't necessarily interested in writing about another president. I had written a book a few years earlier about Theodore Roosevelt. I was interested in writing about science, and I was doing some research on Alexander Graham Bell. And I stumbled upon this story of him trying to help find the bullet in Garfield's back after Garfield was shot by inventing something called an induction balance. And I was stunned. I had never heard the story before. And I couldn't understand why Bell, who was at the height of his fame and his power, he had just invented the telephone 5 years earlier, was only 34 years old, would drop everything he was doing, turn his life upside down to try to help Garfield. And I started doing research on Garfield, and I realized that Garfield was absolutely extraordinary.
Extraordinary in what ways?
Well, first of all, he was a brilliant man. He was born into incredible, extreme poverty. You know, he was literally in a log cabin with a dirt floor and oiled paper windows. So to put himself through college, his first year, he was a janitor and carpenter. By his second year, he was made professor of literature and ancient languages. And by the time he was 26, he was a university president. He knew the entire Aeneid by heart in Latin. And while he was in Congress, he wrote an original proof of the Pythagorean theorem. He was just off the charts.
Tell us what life was like in America back then in 1876 after the Civil War.
So obviously the country is still deeply divided, and you know, Lincoln's assassination only deepened that divide. It's a country full of promise and possibility, but we weren't quite there yet, and there was incredible infighting within the political parties, and not just between the Republicans and the Democrats, but within the Republican Party there was a strong divide between these two warring factions, the very, very conservative believe strongly in patronage and the spoil system, the stalwarts, and then what they were known as the half-breeds, who were reformists, and Garfield belonged to that group.
And how did he come to be president?
Well, Garfield never wanted to be president. In fact, he said he never had what he called presidential fever. When he went to the Republican convention in 1880, he went there to give the nominating address for another man. But that speech, which is extemporaneous, was so powerful and so moving that at one point he's in this huge hall, 15,000 people, and he says, "And so, gentlemen, I ask you, what do we want?" And someone yells, "We want Garfield." And the entire hall just went crazy. And when the balloting began, people started voting for Garfield, even though he wasn't even a candidate and didn't want to be one. And he tried to stop it. But what began as a trickle, became a river, became a torrent of ballots, and suddenly he found himself the Republican nominee for president.
Who else was running at the time?
Well, it was John Sherman, who was the Secretary of Treasury, and William Tecumseh Sherman's younger brother. It was James Blaine, who had been the Speaker of the House, and Ulysses S. Grant, who was running for a third term. And all of those candidates were swept aside in favor of Garfield.
And did they finally come together to support him?
They did not all. Garfield was not only thrust into the position of becoming president, but he was also had his vice president forced upon him. Chester Arthur belonged to the Stalwart, the other faction of the Republican Party, and he was the puppet and really the creation of a man named Roscoe Conkling, who was a senior senator from New York, a vain, preening, incredibly powerful and ruthless man who saw in Arthur his chance to sort of rule the country, and was infuriated when Garfield refused to follow what he asked.
You're such a young woman, and to have become immersed in this kind of history, why did you, to begin with? You've written now a book about Theodore Roosevelt, now a book about Garfield. What was behind that?
Well, you know, what interests me about history are these personal stories. You know, I'm obviously interested in the events and the consequences, but we have these great men, and I think what's interesting is to understand who they were as men, not just as politicians, but really their character. And what I've found through years of research is that you can see them most clearly in their moments of trial, of difficulty, of even desperation, more than in their large moments of public triumph. And so that's why with Theodore Roosevelt, it was after his political career, and it was on this very difficult, very dangerous expedition down an unmapped river in the middle of the Amazon, a trip in which he nearly committed suicide, and showed a kind of quiet courage that we're not used to. We're used to Roosevelt's swagger, and this is a completely different kind of courage. And at this point, this is a man who, as you say, we've largely forgotten, but was such a brilliant man and had so much promise and was so kind and broad-minded. And I wanted to understand who he was and what his loss meant to the country.
Why did Teddy Roosevelt nearly commit suicide?
Well, he had injured himself in the river. They were on this very, very remote river. No one knew what was happening to them. You know, they were hunted by indigenous tribesmen. They were starving. They were desperate. And he became very, very ill, so ill that he could hardly sit up. And they came to a point where they didn't think they could continue on the river, and they were going to have to strike out into the rainforest, every man for himself. And one of his sons was with him, and he believed that he was a danger to the and was to the rest of the men. He didn't want them to be a burden and them trying to get him out as well as themselves. And he had brought with him a lethal dose of morphine, which he had carried on other expeditions, never wanting to be a burden or danger to the other men in the expedition. And he decided that it was time to take it.
But
he didn't. What he realized was he had his son Kermit with him, and Kermit was a very sort of introspective young man, and was at his best when he had a mission, something to accomplish. And Roosevelt knew his son very well, and he realized that the best way to save his son was to let his son save him. And he did. Kermit was really the hero of this expedition. He really saved all the men. He found a way to continue on the river, to get over these incredible rapids, and he saved these men.
You indeed had a personal experience as you were working on that book.
I did. While I was expecting my second child while I was working on the book, and it was actually when my final proofs were due, I'd had a sonogram, and I got a call one morning out of the blue from my OBGYN, and she said, you know, we saw the shadow of something on your last sonogram. You know, it's probably nothing, but I'd like for you to come in tomorrow morning to have a more detailed ultrasound to see if there's anything. And so my husband and I did the next morning, and we found that there was a large tumor, and very quickly realized just, and we had to have the baby that day. I had an hour to go home, pack a bag, get back to the hospital and have the baby.
How far along were you?
Fortunately, I was 37 weeks. So her lungs had developed. She was of good size. But we found out that she had neuroblastoma and stage 4. And we were just thrust into this very extreme situation with, you know, no warning. And that's really how life works so often. You know, you're going along and then you're blindsided. And I certainly saw that again and again in Roosevelt's life and how he approached loss and hardship, and certainly witnessed that with Garfield and his family as well. So it's interesting. All these emotions, they're very familiar to me. And inspirational.
How is your daughter now?
She's doing very well. Thank you for asking. She just started first grade a few weeks ago, and she's still tested, of course, every year, but we have every reason to believe that she's going to be just fine.
I'm so glad.
Thank you very much.
What an extraordinary time for you, trying to finish up this book, and then you have the baby. Was the book delayed because you had
your
baby?
It was interesting because my editor didn't even know I was pregnant because I thought, well, you know, I'll turn in the manuscript, have a few weeks, I'll have the baby. He doesn't need to know. He's in New York. I'm in Kansas City. But so, you know, as I'm driving home to pack my bag, I had to call him and say, I'm having a baby today.
Candace Millard, her new book is titled Destiny of the Republic. When we come back, we'll talk about that title.
More conversation with Diane Rehm is coming up here on WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon. I'm Elliot Francis. It's 218.
Donating your used car to WAMU 88.5 makes a difference. Find out more at 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org and click on support. Thanks. This program of the Diane Rehm Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls. But we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
And welcome back. Candace Millard is with me. She's New York Times bestselling author of The River of Doubt and former editor and writer at National Geographic magazine. Her new book is all about James Garfield, the president who, after 4 months in office, was shot by a distraught and disappointed office holder. The book is titled Destiny of the Republic, a tale of madness, medicine, and murder of a president. Candace, the book begins with an account of a shipwreck. On the night of June 11, 1880, tell us about Charles Guiteau and why he was on the Stonington.
Charles Guiteau was a deeply delusional and deranged young man, and he had tried everything in his life, and he had failed at everything. He was a failed lawyer, a failed evangelist. He had even been in a free love commune and had failed there too. The women in the free love commune nicknamed him Charles Get Out. And he was also, though, at the same time, highly intelligent, very articulate, and he read the newspapers obsessively. And so when Garfield won the nomination in this stunning turn of events, he became obsessed with Garfield, and he decided that he would single-handedly make Garfield president. And out of gratitude, Garfield would make him ambassador to France. You know, this is the height of the spoil system. And so he believed that all he had to do was maybe give a speech and be the first in line with his request, and he would get the appointment he wished for. And so so after the nomination, he gets on the ship to go to New York to campaign for Garfield. And while he's on the ship, it's night, he's standing on the deck, and all of a sudden the ship collides with its sister ship in the middle of the water, and it's this horrible, horrible tragedy. The ship explodes in flames and goes down, and many people die. More than 30 people die on this ship, and Guiteau survives. And he believes that this is a sign for God, that he has been chosen for some unique mission.
So how does he continue his effort to meet Garfield, to campaign for him? He goes on.
He does. He goes. So he's in New York, and he goes to the campaign offices every day, every day. He even goes to Chester Arthur's home. He has written this speech, and he wants to give it. And finally, they say, okay, you can give it at this one little gathering. He gives it for about 5 minutes, runs off the stage when he thinks, okay, I've done my duty. When Garfield's elected, it's because of me. He then moves to Washington.
He believes that.
He honestly believes that. I mean, he's mentally ill. And he moves to Washington, and he goes to the White House and the State Department every single day asking for an appointment. I mean, they know him. And he just becomes more and more obsessed and more delusional, and it just spirals out of control.
Does he, before the assassination, actually meet Garfield?
He does. He, at one point, actually walks into the president's office while the president is there in the office. This is an incredible time. This is 16 years after Abraham Lincoln's assassination. There's still no Secret Service protection for the president. He has a 24-year-old private secretary and an aging policeman, and that is it. And he is forced to meet with the public every day for hours of his day. Anybody can come off the street. He would meet with 100 office seekers every day. And Garfield is desperate. He wants time to work and think. He can do great things for this country if he would just be given the time. But it's just extreme, and Guiteau takes advantage of that.
Tell me about your sources and what you used to create this.
Well, this was one of the reasons I wanted to tell the story, is because there are so many primary sources. As you can imagine, with the assassination of a president, newspaper articles after newspaper articles. But Guiteau in particular, and I think this is very rare for a presidential assassin, I was in his mind. I knew not just his childhood, not just his actions, but his thoughts. Because of his unique illness, because he was delusional, he loved this attention. He was happier when he was in prison than any other time in his life, because he had reporters coming to him to interview him. He wrote an autobiography that was published in the New York Herald. The trial itself, they went through, because it was an insanity defense, every aspect of his childhood. It's nearly 3,000 pages long, the trial transcript. So he had a wife for a little while, and they talked to her, his brothers and sisters, and he loved to talk, and so I know everything about him.
There is another character who is central to this book, even beyond Alexander Graham Bell, and that's Dr. Joseph Lister.
Yes.
Tell us about him.
So 16 years earlier, Joseph Lister had discovered antisepsis, and he was a British surgeon, and he had seen dramatic and immediate results in his own surgical ward, many fewer deaths. And so he had gone throughout Europe, and it had been widely accepted in Europe, and he had come to the United States begging American doctors to sterilize their instruments and their fingers, and they really had dismissed him. They didn't really believe in germs. They laughingly called them invisible germs, and they certainly weren't going to go to all the trouble that antisepsis required. In fact, they called their good old surgical stink. They wouldn't change or wash their surgical aprons. They thought the more blood and pus encrusted, the more experience it showed. And even those who did some antisepsis, they didn't go all the way. For instance, they would sterilize their surgical knives, but if they dropped them during surgery, they would just pick them up and keep using them. Or if they needed both hands, they would hold the knife in their teeth and then continue to use it.
And there, I gather, was not much thought to hand washing.
No, but it's even more than that. Obviously, you need to really sterilize. Joseph Lister used carbolic acid at that time to really kill.
But why was there, do you believe, such resistance to Lister? Was it more than simply this is the way we do things. We're not paying attention to you.
Well, you know, I think it just shows the dangers of arrogance. You know, they had their ways. And interestingly, it wasn't all the doctors. It was really the more experienced, the better respected doctors. There were young doctors who had been studying in Europe and learning about Lister and who saw what was happening with the president and didn't feel that it was their place to speak up against these more experienced. There was a doctor in Kansas who wrote to the first lady after Garfield was shot and said, don't let them probe the wound. Sterilize everything, but no one was listening to them. I think, really a case of willful ignorance and arrogance.
You talked about Garfield's early life of poverty. What about Gateau's life?
He had a difficult childhood. His mother died when he was very young. He had an older sister who really tried to fill that role for him and really throughout his life tried to take care of him. You know, he lived a very peripatetic life, moving from city to city, boarding house to boarding house.
Was he educated at all?
He did. He went to school, went to college for a while in Michigan, but his father was a very obsessive, sort of fanatical Christian with this one particular sect, and had raised Guiteau to believe that too, and that's when he ended up leaving school and joining this Free Love Commune.
And the Free Love Commune was supposed to, what, empower him to become an even better person?
They believed that they could perfect themselves to a point at which they literally would not die. And so they would have these meetings and they would sit down and they would talk about one person's imperfections, and which was incredibly difficult for Guiteau, who had all these delusions of grandeur.
And of course, once Garfield got to the White House, he had to take his wife, his children, but there were already tragedies brewing there.
He had lost two children before, his youngest daughter and his oldest daughter and his youngest son had died. And so, yes, he knew a lot of pain and loss. In fact, his own father had died before he was 2 years old. And Garfield had this sense that he would die as a young man, and he would die an early death. And it was out of character for him because he was a very optimistic, very cheerful young man, and his friends never understood it. But he didn't either, really, but he just couldn't shake this sense.
So Guiteau finally decides why that he's going to kill President Garfield.
So he becomes more and more delusional, more obsessed, and finally he has an encounter with the Secretary of State, who tells him, listen, this is not going to happen. You're not qualified. We're not going to give you this position. And he's angry and hurt, and he goes home and he has what he believes is a divine inspiration, a message from God, that actually Chester Arthur should be president and that he needs to kill the president.
So how does he go about planning
So he has no money, and he borrows some money, and he buys a gun. He's never shot a gun before, and he goes down to the Potomac and practices a little, and he begins to stalk the president. He sits outside of the White House on a park bench, watching every day for Garfield to emerge. He goes to his church, to Garfield's church, thinks he might shoot him in his church. He follows him to a train station. One night, he even watches as Garfield leaves the White House, walks down the street to his Secretary of State's house. They walk around the city. Guiteau follows them the whole way, holding a loaded gun. And it's after that night that he decides, the next opportunity I have, I will shoot the president.
Here is an email from Frank, who says, my mother always said that my great-great-grandmother was with Garfield when he was shot. Her husband was the Postmaster General. As the family told it, she nursed Garfield at the White House until Garfield's wife returned. I assume, he says, that these family stories are true.
Well, there were several people who were there. It's certainly possible. You know, one of the interesting things is there were so many people. He went to the Baltimore and Potomac train station where he was shot, which was where the National Gallery of Art is today. And there he had some of his members of his cabinet with him. He had his two oldest sons with him. And obviously, it was horrific, you know, and they were screaming and crying. And there were several people trying to help him. 10 different doctors came to the station. Many people accompanied him back to the White House, but this one doctor in particular, Dr. Willard Bliss, his first name was Doctor. His parents had named him Doctor. Took over. He just assumed control in the middle of this chaos, and Garfield had never asked him to. Lucretia, Garfield's wife, had never asked him to, but he ends up dismissing all the other doctors, even Garfield's own physician, personal physician who'd been his doctor for years, and just takes control and completely isolates the president inside the White House, literally putting a screen around his bed, letting him have very few visitors. Not even the Secretary of State could see him for days, and just assumes control of his medical care.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Take us back a bit. Did Guiteau simply walk up to him and shoot?
He did. Garfield walked into the train station. Again, there's no protection
for him.
He walks in. His Secretary of State is with him just because he thinks it's unseemly for the president to enter the train station by himself.
Where was he headed?
He was going on a trip, is sort of a family vacation. He was going to go to Williams College, where since he had attended, and he was going to meet his wife, and so it was several multifaceted trip. And Guiteau just steps out of the shadows and shoots him twice, once in the arm and once in the back. But the bullet that hits him in the back, it doesn't hit his spinal cord, it doesn't hit any vital organs, it goes behind his pancreas and insists there.
So they take him back to the White House. I mean, what you talk about here is more horrendous than the actual shooting itself. What happens?
Absolutely. He suffered incredibly. It's just astonishing. This Dr. Bliss and a very small group of surgeons he had with him repeatedly inserted unsterilized fingers and instruments in Garfield's back, probing for this bullet, and the infection grows and grows and grows. By the end, he is just riddled with infection. You know, he has pneumonia, infection-induced pneumonia in both of his lungs. He has an abscess that's half a foot in diameter near his liver. He had at one point an abscess in his face that paralyzed part of his face and ruptured, and he nearly drowned. There was so much pus. And his doctors are calling this healthy pus and a good sign, and telling the public, they're giving, you know, reports saying he's doing well.
How does Alexander Graham Bell get involved?
So Bell had a small laboratory here in D.C., and he learns of the shooting, and he remembers that he had this induction bounce, something he had invented a few years earlier to basically get rid of static in the telephone line. And he remembered that it was also a metal detector. And he gets a hold of the White House, and he says, I can help. And Bliss is desperate by this point, knows that things are not going well, and he lets Bell help.
And how?
So Bell continues to work on this invention and work on it and increase the range. And he comes into the White House, and he uses it on the president. Unfortunately, two things happen. One, they don't tell him that the president is on a very new kind of bed at that time that had metal coils in it, which would obviously affect a metal detector. And they don't tell them that. Two, and worse than that, Bliss believed and had publicly stated that the bullet was on the president's right side and would only let Bliss examine and use his induction balance on the right side of the president's body.
So Bliss would only let Bell...
Did I say yes? Yeah. Bliss would only let Bell examine the right side of the president's body. The bullet was on the left.
So nobody found the bullet.
Until the autopsy.
And by this time, President Garfield is riddled with infection.
And starving to death. You know, this is a very handsome, 6 feet tall, 210-pound man who was reduced to 130 pounds by the time he couldn't keep any food down. And as well as this infection, they're also, I mean, this is a gunshot victim. They're giving him rich foods to eat. They're giving him alcohol, morphine, and he's just vomiting. He can't keep anything down, and they're desperately trying to find ways to feed him.
Poor Lucretia.
It was so sad. That's one of the saddest parts of the story because they had such a close relationship. You know, they had a very difficult early years to their marriage, but very much in love by the end.
Candace Millard, she has written a new book about the life and death of President James Garfield. It's titled Destiny of the Republic.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, a smart growth feud in aisle 5, how plans for a new Whole Foods in Prince George's County ignited a new debate about traffic and economic development, plus teetering towards a failed state 5 years into Mexico's drug war. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
This is the WAMU 88.5 Community Minute.
Hi. I'm Reverend Clark Lobenstein, the director for the Interfaith Conference of Metropolitan Washington. The Interfaith Conference, or IFC as it's often called, was created in 1978 out of the conviction that community can be created from diversity, and that in diversity is the unity that can change the world. The Interfaith Conference now brings together 11 historic faith communities with this mission. The Baha'i, Buddhist, Hindu, Islamic, Jain, Jewish, Latter-day Saints, Protestant, Roman Catholic, Sikh, and Zoroastrian traditions in this region. The opportunities of collaborating with peoples of many faiths who may come from historically divisive places are, you know, get me up in the morning, get me out of the house in the morning, and it's fabulous. I'm very blessed with the work that I do. And it is a great gift.
This has been the WAMU 88.5 Community Minute. For more information, visit WAMU.org and click on Community.
And it's time to open the phones now for Candace Millard, her fascinating story of the life and death of President James Garfield just 4 months after he took office. Remembering at the time, no Secret Service, no police protection, people simply walking into his office when he was out in public, no protection. He was assassinated. Well, we shouldn't say that. He was shot by Charles Guiteau, but he did not die of those shots. He died of massive infection because of the carelessness with which doctors at the time and in the mode of that current practice of medicine treated him. Isn't that fair to say?
That is fair to say. Unfortunately, they should have known better. You know, Joseph Lister, this was not a newfangled theory, and they chose not to. They chose to rely on old methods, and I think one of the problems really, I think it was worse for Garfield because he was president. You know, at this time, there were many, many Civil War veterans walking around with bullets inside of them who had survived. But the fact that he was president meant that he got really too much medical care. He would have been better off if they had just left him alone.
All right, we're going to open the phones now. First to Juan in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. It's a real honor to speak to the author because I think River of Doubt is just one of the greatest books I've ever read.
Thank you very much.
About Theodore Roosevelt. It was refreshing to have an episode where Theodore Roosevelt's heroism wasn't tainted by his usual jingoism, which sometimes, kind of marred things a little bit. And my question is, are there any plans to make River of Doubt into a movie? It just seems like it would be just made for cinema. And my second question is about President Garfield. Do you think that Guiteau should have been executed? It seems like on a good day he was half psychotic, and I don't see how they can argue that the man wasn't just a lunatic. And finally, I also read that Garfield could write in one, with one hand in Greek while writing with the other in Latin. I don't know if that's neurologically possible, but I read that somewhere, and I thought that was kind of interesting. I'll get off the phone to hear your
voice. All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. The River of Doubt, it has been optioned. It was actually optioned a few years ago by John Turteltaub. And so we'll see. There's a script. You know, who knows if it'll ever be made into a movie. But the script is actually quite good, so we'll see.
Did you do this script?
No, I didn't. Yeah. I did not write the script. I wouldn't know the first thing about screenwriting, but you know, that takes some liberties, but that's to be expected, I guess. As far as Guiteau, you know, he was insane. He was clearly insane, and I think that really that's one of the tragedies of this story. If anyone should have been found not guilty by reason of insanity, it was Charles Guiteau. You know, his family knew that he was insane and actually had tried several times to have him institutionalized, but he kept sort of disappearing. If he had been institutionalized, then, you know, Garfield never would have been shot. And so I think it's just one of the tragedies. But the country was so grief-stricken and so enraged that they were going to see him hanged. And he did hang, unfortunately.
And then the third question,
the left hand, right hand. Yes, that's an old story. You know, I think it's actually probably apocryphal. I mean, he certainly did know both languages, ancient Greek and Latin, and could write in both. Whether he could do that at the same time, you know, has not been proven, but it's a good story.
How quickly did the public learn that the president had died of massive infection rather than the bullet wounds themselves?
Right away. So there was an autopsy right away, and his doctors were there, and they were as surprised as anyone. You know, they first of all, they find that the bullet's on the left side. They find that what they had assumed was a track of the bullet was actually they had made by their probings, and it had filled with pus, and they see all of this massive infection. And so the autopsy results are released, and the country knows right away that their president didn't have to die, and they know why he did.
Now, what positive effects came out of that?
So Dr. Bliss was immediately vilified, and you know, in newspapers and medical journals, everyone openly says it's because antisepsis wasn't followed, and we have lost this promising president because of that. And it changes immediately, and it saves countless lives because of that. The medical practice throughout the United States changes immediately, and antisepsis is adopted.
James writes, I'd like to ask Ms. Millard if she has any information about the final resting place of Guiteau's remains. I live in Bethlehem, Connecticut. The local rumor is he was buried in an unmarked grave in the North Cemetery, but there's never been any real historic confirmation.
Well, after his hanging, he was first buried actually in the prison, but the next day his remains were exhumed for study, and they're actually at the National Museum of Health and Medicine here in Washington, D.C.
Really?
And I saw them. Yeah, it's really moving. They have a section of Garfield's spine that shows where the bullet entered. It was used during the trial. And in another drawer, they have the remains of John Wilkes Booth and Charles Guiteau. And they have it's grim, but they have a jar filled with chunks of Guiteau's brain. His brain was divided up and sent to experts around the country to study it to see if they could see physical signs of insanity.
What happened to his wife, Lucretia?
So Lucretia went on to live many years, you know, was devastated, and her daughter said if it hadn't been for her children, she would have had a hard time finding a reason to live. But she was a very strong woman, you know, had endured the deaths of two of her children. And so she went back to their farmhouse that they had in Ohio, and a fund was raised for him, for their family, because they did not have much money. And she used that to build a wing onto the house and established a first presidential library. She kept all of their letters. They're at the Library of Congress today, but that library still exists.
You said you had a hard time writing about her death.
about Garfield's death,
no,
about President Garfield's
her death.
Oh, I had a hard
Lucretia's death.
It was actually... Oh,
I thought you said you had...
I'm sorry.
But perhaps it was Garfield's
It was President death. Garfield's death. I had come to care about him, really, over these years of studying him, and had real affection for him. And when I needed to write his death scene, it was... Yeah, it was difficult for me.
All right, to Inverness, Florida. Good morning, Pete.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure. Garfield was a man of destiny, and I'd like to briefly mention his actions at the Battle of Chickamauga during the Civil War. He was the chief of staff to the Army commander, and one wing of the Army was defeated. And a decision was made. One of the men had to go back to the base, and one of the men had to ride to the other wing of the Army. And the Army commander decided to go back to the base, and he was eventually disgraced, and Garfield rode to join the other wing of the Army and became a great hero. And if the roles had been reversed, Garfield would never have made it to be president.
He did become a hero during the Civil War, absolutely. In that instance, and also the Battle of Middle Creek, in which he was up against a much, much larger Confederate force, and he divided his much smaller Union Army, Union Regiment, into three divisions and attacked first on one side, then on another, and then on a third side, and completely confused and frightened the much larger Confederate force, and really was instrumental in saving Kentucky for the Union. And it did. It made him, they promoted him to Brigadier General, and it made him a national hero.
And to Todd in Concord, Michigan. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Another great show.
Oh, thanks.
I just had a quick question. My great-grandmother, who came from Sweden, loved James A. Garfield. She came in the 1890s. She played the guitar, and the song was passed down, and my grandmother used to sing it when I was a child. And I'll just sing a couple bars, and it went, "My name is Charles Guiteau, a name I'll never deny. I'll be taken to the scaffold tomorrow for to die. Little did I think that in my youthful bloom I'd be taken to the scaffold to meet my fatal doom." And the song goes on, and it has several verses. I'm just curious to know if that's something that she had made up or if there was anything ever published or printed.
Well, you know, there's that song. I haven't seen it printed, but there's also a wonderful song that Johnny Cash sang about Charles Guiteau shot a good man down, and it's a wonderful song. You can there's actually a YouTube video of him singing it.
Really?
It's fantastic. Yeah, it was. You know, this was a huge loss, devastating to the country at the time, and so a lot of things obviously came out of it. That was a wonderful song.
Do you recognize the song Todd sang?
I have heard it before.
Yeah.
I have. Yes.
Todd, you have a great voice.
You do.
Well, thank you, Diane. And like I say, a great show. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for calling. And let's go to Don in Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious about criminal charges against the doctors. If a doctor did today what they did then, well, there'd be lawsuits and there would be criminal. I'm curious about criminal charges against the doctors, the dirty instruments and filthy hands.
You know, that's a great question. It was a very different time, and no, there were no criminal charges. But Dr. Bliss, you know, he lost his medical practice. He really, you know, the last thing Bliss wanted was for Garfield to die.
Of course.
But, and he was desperate. But he worked and worked and worked night and day with Garfield, and so he sort of lost his health. But he insisted to the end that he had given Garfield extraordinary surgical care, and in fact he presented Congress with a very large bill and was offended when Congress refused to pay it.
Really?
I know. It's just extreme. Yeah, he just refused to admit that he had done anything.
Really?
He never admitted he had done anything wrong. On the contrary.
Here's an email from Mary in North Carolina who says she read somewhere a long time ago that when Garfield was shot, he was near what I believe was the World's Fair, where there was a tent showcasing a new invention, the X X-ray. It was said if he only knew about this helpful invention, they would have found the bullet sooner.
That may have been McKinley. The X-ray wasn't, medical X-ray wasn't invented for another 14 years, and McKinley was shot 20 years later.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and until after McKinley was assassinated,
then
you didn't have Secret Service.
Incredible, isn't it?
Outrageous!
I know. Three presidential assassinations. Well, you know, they didn't think that Lincoln's assassination was. They thought it was due to war. You know, it was just a result of war. And then they thought Garfield's because he was a frustrated office seeker, and so they had civil service reform. And then with McKinley, they finally got it.
And have to protect then email from Joanne in Florida, who says, amazingly enough, there is still much of the same willful arrogance as there was in Garfield's day when it comes to the washing of one's hands. MRSA, the infection, would not be as rampant if physicians, as well as other hospital staff, would simply wash their hands between each patient.
Well, you know, I think then as now, it largely depends on the doctor you get. You know, you have to battle arrogance and knowledge. You know, and everything Garfield stood for, scientific progress, broad-mindedness, education, would have saved his life and would save lives today. And, you know, again, as a mother of a child who was born with cancer, I can see the great promise and the incredible ability of the doctors we have. And there's no person more grateful to doctors than I am. And we have extraordinary doctors. But they have to be open-minded, and they have to set their own ego aside.
How do you think the U.S. did change after Garfield's assassination?
Well, we had almost immediate civil service reform. You know, Chester Arthur signed the Pendleton Act, which brought about civil service reform. But more than that, it really brought the country together for the first time since the Civil War. Lincoln's death had only deepened that divide, but Garfield was respected and trusted by freed slaves, by Southerners, by immigrants, by pioneers. Really, the whole country came together and mourned his loss as one.
And how do you see his legacy?
You know, he was a brilliant man and so much promise. And so I think in the end, what the story teaches us is the dangers of arrogance and the importance of, again, everything that Garfield stood for, of progress, in science especially, of open-mindedness, of tolerance, of education. You know, he established the first Department of Education. You know, all of these things that he couldn't do through his life, maybe we can see and achieve because of what we know about his death.
Have you, by chance, distributed this book to the members of Congress?
I sent a copy to Senator Durbin because he had written to me. He read The River of Doubt and liked it. And I met Senator McConnell when I was on my book tour for the River of Doubt, and I sent him a copy as well. So
excellent.
We'll see if they read it.
Oh, that's terrific. I want to congratulate you, Candace. It's really an extraordinary book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
I hope it does very, very well.
Thank you.
Candace Millard, she's a New York Times bestselling author of The River of Doubt about Theodore Roosevelt, and now her newest book about James Garfield, who was assassinated 4 months after being elected president. It's titled Destiny of the Republic. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Hi there, I'm Rebecca Shear, host of WAMU 88.5's Metro Connection, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today we visit the Brookland neighborhood of Northeast D.C., then we head to Crystal City, Virginia.
My name is Rosie Dempsey. I'm 53 years old, and I live in Brookland, a neighborhood in Northeast Washington, D.C. What is traditionally called Brookland is defined by Michigan Avenue, South Dakota, Rhode Island Avenue, and the railroad tracks. Brookland has always been integrated from its very earliest days, and the neighborhood was always known for its Italian Americans, Irish Americans, first generation. Always been known for its African American community here. Today, that's still the case. We have some really interesting institutions around which we can meet as neighbors. The Franciscan Monastery gives, I think, 6 to 8 months out of the year, has a spaghetti dinner where you can go for dinner for $7. My favorite part about living in Brookland, frankly, are the friends I've made here. And I love being in a community that I feel that is a real community.
I'm Chris Terrell, and I'm a resident in Crystal City, one of the Virginia suburbs. I'm originally from Sweden. We had lots of old factories and a lot of open space then, back in the 70s and 80s. There was an interest in making use of the area for both residential and office buildings. One of the first buildings that was put up here, a residential building, got known for an unusually large chandelier hanging in the lobby. Soon that building became known, apart from its street address, as Crystal House. All the new buildings that were put up, they were named Crystal something, and gradually the whole neighborhood became used as Crystal City. If you look around today, most buildings are not taller than 10.